Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is September the 23rd, 2020. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. A silent form of discrimination that seems to have no champions in Congress to end it is ageism. This form of discrimination crosses all gender, religious, political, and ethnic groups. Ageism is a stereotyping and discrimination against individuals or groups on the basis of their age. Ageism can take many forms, including prejudicial attitudes, discriminatory practices, or institutional policies and practices that perpetuate stereotyping beliefs. The number of Americans 60 and older is growing, but society still isn't embracing the aging population trying to obtain equal standing in the workplace. In a survey of people of ages 60 and older, nearly 80% of the respondents reported experiencing ageism. There was a major class action suit against IBM on ageism. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission found giant IBM discriminated against older workers when making thousands of layoffs between 2013 through 2018. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission released the following text as follows. On behalf of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, I issue the following determination on the merits of the subject charge under the Age Discrimination in Employment Act of 1967 as amended. Respondent IBM is an employer within the meaning of the ADEA. All requirements for coverage have been met. Charging parties allege they and a class of similarly situated individuals were discharged based on their age. Individual charging parties also allege discrimination based on national origin, sex, race, retaliation, and disability. Respondent denies discriminating against charging parties. Respondent asserts that charging parties were discharged as part of a series of resource actions designed to reduce headcounts and decrease costs. Respondent contends that there was no centralized decision-making and that each individual manager was responsible for selecting individuals in his or her group that would be laid off. Respondents offered various reasons for selection for layoffs, including performance, relevant skill, utilization, and consolidation of services. The commission investigation reveals that respondent conducted resource actions analyzed by the EEOC between 2013 and 2018 that had an adverse impact on employees in the protected age group, that's called PAG, and the investigation uncovered top-down messaging from respondents' highest ranks directing managers to engage in an aggressive approach to significantly reduce the headcount of older workers to make room for early professional hires. Analysis shows it was primarily older workers, 85.85%, in the total potential pool of those considered for layoffs. Evidence uncovered older employees who were laid off and told that their skills were out of date, only to be brought back as contract workers at a lower rate of pay with fewer benefits. EEOC received corroborating testimony from dozens of witnesses nationwide supporting its discriminatory animus based on age. IBM laid off an unknown number of workers in North Carolina during that time as it slashed the size of the statewide workforce including at its large campus in Raleigh Triangle Park. The EEOC's decision came after hearing complaints from charging parties who alleged that they and a class of similarly situated individuals were discharged based on their age. Individual charging parties also alleged discrimination based on national origin, sex, race, retaliation, and disability. IBM denied the allegations. IBM contended that there was no centralized decision-making and that each individual manager was responsible for selecting individuals in his or her group that would be laid off. IBM offered various reasons for selection for layoffs, including performance, relevant skills, utilization, and consolidation of services. Of course, it's not supported when they rehired the laid-off people and paid them a lower salary and cut their benefits. IBM stood by its defense. IBM makes decisions based on the needs of its business units, not age. They will continue to defend this matter vigorously. EEOC expects IBM and the charging parties to now negotiate a resolution. Having determined that there is reason to believe that violations have occurred, the commission now invites IBM to join with it in an effort toward a just resolution of this matter. A commission representative will contact each party in the near future to begin conciliation. If you decline, in other words, if you're one of the affected members, to enter into conciliation discussions, or when the commission's representative is unable to secure an acceptable conciliation agreement, the director shall so inform the parties, advising them of the court enforcement alternatives available to aggrieved persons and the commission. All companies should take note of this ruling by the EEOC. IBM is just an example of how many workplaces practice ageism. Of course, when those are in the management get older, they'll find themselves in the uncomfortable position of being discriminated. Firefox 10 and Firefox Notes have been decommissioned. As Mozilla tightens and refines its product focus in 2020, they announced the end of life for two legacy services that grew out of the Firefox test pilot program, Firefox 10 and Firefox Notes. Both services are being decommissioned and will no longer be a part of their product family. I was using Sen to transmit large files of pre-recorded programs to the studio. The files were necessarily large for CD-like quality. Mailing in files was limited to 25 megabytes. An hour-long CD-like quality at 192 bits per second in MP3 format is over 80 megabytes. Firefox Sen was a promising tool for encrypted file sharing. Sen had a loyal audience and real signs of value throughout its life. Unfortunately, some abusive users were beginning to use Sen to ship malware and conduct spear phishing attacks. This summer, Mozilla took Firefox Sen offline to address this challenge. All it took was a few bad apples that deprived the majority of users the service of an excellent product. In the intervening period, Mozilla weighed the cost of their overall portfolio and strategic focus. Unfortunately, they made this decision not to relaunch the service. Because the service is already offline, no major changes in status are expected. Firefox Notes was initially developed to experiment with new methods of encrypted data syncing. Having served that purpose, they kept the product as a little utility tool for Firefox and Android users. In early November, they will decommission the Android Notes app and syncing service. The Firefox Notes desktop browser extension will remain available for existing installs, and they will include an option to export all notes. However, it will no longer be maintained by Mozilla and will no longer be installable. This decision allows them to sharpen their focus on Mozilla VPN, Firefox Monitor, and Firefox Private Network. Well, what alternatives are available? You can use any one of the half-dozen BitTorrent apps to share some large files with a few friends. BitTorrent is the official torrent client of the BitTorrent protocol, the largest decentralized peer-to-peer protocol, and it's used to transfer large files and data over the Internet. BitTorrent, the company behind the BitTorrent client, also makes another similar and highly popular torrenting app called MicroTorrent. BitTorrent apps requires end-to-end installation of software. You may not have a problem with installing an application on your end to transfer a large file, but to whom you want to send a large file, this adds to the burden of easily transferring large files. There is another method that I use. I prefer file.pizza. Yes, that is the URL, file.pizza. No setup is required on either ends of the transmission. It is a free peer-to-peer file transfer in your browser. What you want to send is never stored anywhere other than your system and the recipient system. It is an open-source application used to transfer files via WebRTC and WebTorrent. Open the website, select a file, and you are given a link to send to the recipient. For as long as the page is open on your end, users can download from the link provided via WebTorrent. Using WebRTC, FilePizza eliminates the initial upload step required by other web-based file sharing services. When senders initialize a transfer, they receive a template link they can distribute to recipients. Upon visiting this link, recipients' browsers connect directly to the sender's browser and may begin downloading the selected file. Because data is never stored in any intermediary server, the transfer is fast, private, and secure. By the way, when you upload the name of your file to be transferred, they generate a link that you can paste in your email message for the recipient of your file. The description contains one of the various descriptions of pizza pie with added filling. In other words, there's no meta tags that can be used other than a pizza description. A researcher at Malibites has confirmed phones for low-income users are hacked before they're turned on. The device, paid for by the federally funded Lifeline program for low-income people, are overrun with pop-up ads that made it unusable. Despite multiple factory resets, the problem wouldn't go away. The phone settings and update apps contain code that allow them to load malicious apps known as adware. The adware displayed ads that covered user screens no matter what they're doing on their phones. Because the phones and their service plans were subsidized by a U.S. program, taxpayers are funding the data that was used to display the promotional campaigns. On top of that, the adware prevented the phones doing their intended job, keeping low-income people connected to vital services via phone and internet. Pre-installed malware was found in phones distributed by Lifeline programs from American Network Solutions and Unimax. Unimax said in a statement that it had created a security patch to fix a vulnerability in its settings app. However, it disagreed that the vulnerability in the app qualified as malware. American Network Solutions couldn't be reached for comment. By making phones essentially unusable, adware puts low-income people at risk of being cut off from the world, which is especially troubling during the coronavirus pandemic. Families are struggling to connect to the internet for their children's schooling. Some facing homelessness rely on their devices to stay connected to doctors who can't see them in person and apply for benefits. In California, about 14,000 people live alone in hotel rooms, depend on phones to stave off loneliness after being evacuated from homeless shelters. It is their way to connect to the world, and the internet is through phones. How does the adware get on the phones? The researcher found a settings app and update app could covertly install third-party software on the user's phone. Users can't uninstall either app without making the devices unusable. The researcher found a way to turn off the malicious code without completely uninstalling the apps, but it requires users to connect their phones to a laptop and run specialty software. For people in the Lifeline program, a laptop might not be available, and the instructions might be challenging for people without training. Unimax's assertion that code in the apps amounted to a security vulnerability and was not malware. They said it appears that Malibites was incorrectly identifying legitimate functions as malware. Assurance Wireless didn't supply specific response to the more recent findings about the phone made by American Network Solutions. Because the code Malibytes identified can let the settings and update apps surreptitiously load unwanted adware. The researchers have stood by their finding that the apps contain malware. The Lifeline program is overseen by the FCC. The phone service providers typically either function as subsidiaries of big-name phone carriers or run their service through the big carrier networks. Assurance Wireless is a division of T-Mobile. How the malicious code get onto the phone is unknown because third party could have access to the phone software at various points in the manufacturing process. There is no way of knowing whether either phone maker or the carriers had any knowledge of the problems before Malibytes made its findings public. Budget phone makers typically use pre-made software from Android for apps that control settings and updates. It would be illegal for the phone manufacturer to tweak those apps to allow for the secret installation of adware because they would be making money from ad impression and clicks made possible by Lifeline funds. It is federal law that Lifeline funds are prohibited from supporting the cost of the handset or any other end-user device or software. The security of American cell phone is critical, and the FCC urges Lifeline providers to protect consumers from adware and malware. The agency declined to answer a question about whether it's investigating findings on different phone models. There are other ways for malware to slip in. It's entirely possible phone manufacturers aren't aware of the malicious capabilities of the phones before they go out to users. Instead, thin margins on the devices could lead phone makers to review the software on their phones less thoroughly than a name brand would. A plausible place for it to happen could be what's called Software Review House, a third-party service that reviews code for phone makers before it gets installed onto devices. Someone working in the review house could slip the malicious code into the apps. Unless they were compared line by line with the code sent out to the testing house, you wouldn't find it. Unusable Lifeline phones is a problem for many Lifeline users. Everyone needs a phone to apply for jobs, call 911, call doctors, and stay in touch with the loved ones. Every single user of cell phones deserves the right to have unobstructed phone call and text message access. IBM's Watson Advertising, also known as the advertising arm for IBM's weather company Enterprise, announced it will be rolling out a new way to track and target us all in a way that's supposedly more privacy-forward than the typical cookie-adjacent tech that we've all come to know and hate. Their answer apparently is to lump a ton of other types of sensitive data, like what we buy and where we shop, and use that instead. Watson Advertising Weather Targeting leverages enterprise-grade AI to analyze over 500 advertising triggers with up to 6 variables per trigger across 42,000 zip codes every hour, increasing the amount of actionable insights the company generates for brands. With this collaboration, IBM Watson Advertising will introduce a new suite of triggers and insight reports that will harness Nielsen's RMS data and weather from IBM's The Weather Company to provide brands with actionable advertising solutions that do not rely on personally identifiable information, third-party cookies, or identifiers. Up until now, the Weather Channel's app, just like countless other free-to-download apps, partially rely on certain identifiers, like your device's unique mobile ID and location, into marketers' hands, despite the fact that combining a unique tag on a given phone with that phone location give both marketers and federal officials the ability to trace and target that phone and its owner with pretty terrifying accuracy, and up until pretty recently, the ad industry managed to hide behind the excuse that because this data didn't say contain any directly identifiable information like the phone owner's name or address, nuggets like that mobile identifier were deemed effectively anonymous and untouched by current privacy regulations here in the United States. Apple announced at this year's Worldwide Developers Conference that iOS 14 software upgrade this fall would allow iPhone users to put a stop to an app's ability to collect this mobile ID without that user's explicit consent, the same way the company's previous OS update cracked down on location permission settings. Naturally, the ad industry objected, but developers across the planet are trying to figure out a new way to track and target consumers, of course against their will or otherwise. With a new update, Apple generously gave them half a year to presumably sort out a workaround. Which brings us to the Weather Channel's announcement. Ultimately, if the company's app is a cutoff from your phone's tag or precise location over the next few months, the effects on its business or our privacy will ultimately be minimal. While the app's probably best known for, well, collecting data on the weather, it also spent the past 2 years aggregating even more data from third-party brokers to figure out the way that weather impacts how we surf the web and shop in stores. Now, that tracking the way we surf is a smidge harder. It makes sense that the Watson team needs to shift its focus onto shopping. The end result isn't that we're tracked any less, just that we're tracked in a different way. The weather, for example, invokes certain moods in people and can have a direct impact on their buying behavior in a way that goes beyond umbrella buying during a rainstorm or ordering snow boots in the winter. Watson tracks aggregate behavior in an effort to reveal the less obvious stuff. For instance, it found that sales of baking chocolate and cocoa increased by 62% in northwest central states such as Kansas, Iowa, and Missouri during an unseasonably warm and rainy one-day forecast, while wine sales were up by 25% during a one-day forecast for clear conditions in east-north central United States, which includes Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan. Factors like humidity, temperature, and other weather-related data points can actually be quite revealing. In other words, the weather app isn't just telling marketing types whether it's raining where I happen to be, but also how I will respond to that particular bout of bad weather and whether I'm the type to stay inside and bake or stay inside and binge, drink, or stay inside and, well, not do anything at all. It's just about tracking the weather, but tracking the way it's impacting our collective moods as a whole. Right now, a lot of folks can probably sum up that mood in one word: fear. Some of the most damaging wildfires in recent memory are raging across the West Coast right now, forcing hundreds of thousands of people to flee their homes and have killed more than 30 thus far. Meanwhile, states like Mississippi and Alabama are gearing up for the second massive hurricane to hit the Gulf Coast in less than a month. In situations like these, where sticking your head outside to check the weather means getting a lungful of ash or worse, digital tools for tracking the weather, apps included, are less of a luxury and more of a necessity. And as far as IBM's concerned, it's a necessity that's extremely lucrative, whether you realize it or not. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. This week, he will be talking about insider threats to the company.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I bring you some of my background, some of my history as being an IT professional for 30 years now. And this particular section is one of the ones that really keeps IT professionals up at night. Depending on where they are in the company, what they do, sometimes this is a lesser important item, sometimes it's a major important item, and it should be throughout the company a major important item, but somebody has to be responsible for it. And what is it? Okay, so I'm talking about threats to the company. And specifically, this week I want to highlight insider threats. I just want to spend a little bit of time. We think of, you know, phishing and malware, and we think of a lot of other things. But one of the things that a lot of people overlook is the threat to the company by insiders. Now, insiders doesn't just mean somebody who is currently an employee with a company. It doesn't necessarily mean somebody who even was a past employee. This includes contractors. This includes actually anybody who goes through your facility. This is something I learned when I was working in the aerospace industry, and it's something that they take it very seriously. There's something called ITAR, International Trafficking in Arms Regulations. And what it says is that nobody should come into your company that is from another country without you alerting the Homeland Security, the Department of State, and it gets into a lot more intricate details of who you contact and all of that. But it has to do with the aerospace company I was working for was making parts for military airplanes. We think of this as innocuous. All right, it's a big hunch of a hunk of metal. It's just sitting over there, and what is anybody going to do with that? It's not like we're guarding government secrets, but yet we were. The exact dimensions of how, and I'll just pick an airplane at random, the F-16, the exact dimensions of how that is built, how that's put together, all of the different things on how you treat the metals, all of the different information that might go along with that is a secret. They try to make sure that as few secrets get out as possible. So when we talk about everyone who passes through your company could be somebody who's intending to get information, it extends to even the visitors. It doesn't take but just a few minutes for somebody to walk up to a computer and just stick in a flash drive and grab just a few files, a few very important files. Or in the case of the aerospace industry, it wasn't even a matter of trying to get all of the information in regards to how the F-16 is built. It wasn't a matter of even trying to figure out, you know, big, huge, massive, top secret bits and pieces of information within the airplane. It was simply a matter of any little bit of information could be combined with other little bits of information from other suppliers, from other locations, from other resources, and you slowly assemble all of these different things together. See, an insider attack is not always a one-shot deal. It isn't somebody who is, you know, sitting there and, oh, I'm going to download the entire customer database and then I'm going to quit tomorrow. No. Sometimes there are these low-level attacks which stretch over a very long period of time. They are set up as a very intricate, detailed, get a little piece of information here, get another little piece of information there. Because when you think about it, the perpetrator of one of these insider threats, every act that they're doing can seem small, minute, minuscule, and they take very careful steps to cover all of their tracks along the way. But it's a matter of you put all of these bits and pieces together. So they find out, they look at a piece of material. Oh, that's interesting. And they might even ask just an innocuous question. What's that material? Oh, that's this particular aluminum. That's this particular titanium, whatever it is. And then they find out through another person who went in, yes, that's actually, it happens to be, 7 feet long on this particular edge, and it's curved to 32.7 degrees. And they get all of these little pieces of information, and then somebody can go through and they track all of this. Believe it or not, I kid you not, this is the type of information that they go through And they have they've proven that people have gotten information off of very little bits and pieces of innocuous details. Of course, I'm talking about the aerospace industry, but it doesn't matter. When you accumulate enough information, when a bad guy accumulates enough information, there are so many different things that they can do. They can do blackmail, or they can do extortion. They can sabotage systems. They can perform intellectual property theft. They can do stalking. They can do asset destruction. They can do so many things. And an insider, someone who has just a little bit of access to little bits and pieces of information, can actually do an amazing amount of damage. This is my request of you. Keep an eye out. Just because it seems small, just because it seems like nothing, doesn't mean anything. It could be really big. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Two years ago, Microsoft sank a data center off the coast of Orkney in a wild experiment. Orkney consists of islands, a group of more than 70 islands and islets, only about 20 of which are inhabited in Scotland. It lies north of the Scottish mainland. That data center has now been retrieved from the ocean floor, and Microsoft researchers are assessing how it has performed and what can they learn from it. The first conclusion is that the cylinder pack with servers had a lower failure rate than a conventional data center. When the container was hauled off the seabed around half a mile offshore, after being placed there in May of 2018, just 8 of the 855 servers on board had failed. That compares very well with a conventional data center. Microsoft called it Project Natick. They said the failure rate in the water is 1/8 of what they see on land. The team is speculating that the greater reliability may be connected to the fact that there were no humans on board, and that nitrogen rather than oxygen was pumped into the capsule. They think it has to do with this nitrogen atmosphere that reduces corrosion and is cool, and people not banging things around. Orkney was chosen for the trial by Microsoft. It was chosen because it was the center for renewable energy research in a place where the climate was temperate, perhaps even chilly. The idea was that the cost of cooling computers would be lower if they were underwater. The white cylinder emerged from the cold waters with a coating of algae, barnacles, and sea anemones after a day-long operation. But inside, the data center was functioning well and is now being closely examined so that the research team can learn more. As more and more of our data is stored in the cloud, there's growing concern about the vast energy demands of the data centers, as well as where you're going to find space for all these data centers. Project Natick was partly about working out whether the clusters of small underwater data centers for short-term use might be a commercial proposition, but also an attempt to learn broader lessons about energy efficiency in cloud computing. All of Orkney's electricity comes from wind and solar power, but there was no issues in keeping the underwater data center supplied with power. Microsoft had been able to run well on what most land-based data centers consider an unreliable grid. They are hopeful that their findings say maybe we don't need to have quite as much infrastructure focus on power and reliability. Underwater data centers might sound an outlandish idea, but David Ross, who has been a consultant to the data center industry for many years, says the project has great potential. Microsoft believes organizations facing a natural disaster or a terrorist attack might find it attractive. You could effectively move something to a more secure location without having all the huge infrastructure costs of constructing a building. It's flexible and cost-effective. Microsoft is cautious about saying when an underwater data center might be a commercial product, but is confident that it has proved the idea has value. They think that they're past the point where this is a science experiment. Now it's simply a question of what do we want to engineer? Would it be a little one or be a large one? The experiment on Orkney is over, but the hope is that the result will be more environmentally friendly data storage, both on land and underwater. What does the data center look like underwater? The construction of the data center consists of a large cylindrical tube with a diameter of 9.2 feet across and a length of 40 feet. It is about the size of a shipping container aboard a ship, train, or truck. It's not very large at all. It housed 855 servers. What powered all these servers? 100% locally produced and renewable electricity from onshore wind and solar, offshore tide and wave. Electrical power consumption was 240 kilowatts. This storage unit consisted of 12 racks containing 864 standard Microsoft data center servers with field programmable gate array architecture and applications acceleration, and a total 27.6 petabytes of disk. This NATIC data center is as powerful as several thousand high-end consumer PCs and has enough storage for about 5 million movies. By the way, of the 855 servers, each was configured with 3 terabytes of data. This is a lot of data. How long did it take to set up and install this data center? Design goal of Project NATIC to deploy was less than 90 days from factory to operation. The planned length of operation without maintenance is for 5 years. That was a very fast setup. A natural question is, how would a NATIC data center impact the environment? Microsoft's goal is to create a sustainable data center which leverages locally produced green energy, providing customers with additional options to meet their own sustainability requirements. NATIC data centers are envisioned to be fully recycled, made from recycled material, which in turn is recycled at the end of the life of the data center. A NATIC data center co-located with offshore renewable energy sources could be truly zero emission, no waste products, whether due to power generation or human maintainers are emitted into the environment. We see this as an opportunity to field long-lived, resilient data centers that operate lights out, nobody on site, with very high reliability for the entire life of the deployment, possibly as long as 10 years. NATIC data centers consume no water for cooling or any other purpose. Data centers are responsible for between 1 to 1.5% of global electricity usage. Anything on the internet also requires those applications to run on a computer. The global cloud computing market size is expected to grow from $371 billion this year to $832.1 billion by the year 2025 at a compound annual growth rate of 17.5% during the forecast period. This is an exponential growth. These are all amazing statistics and represents how cloud computing can become a game changer for any business. The birth of the modern cloud dates back to the mid-1990s when AT&T first introduced an online platform for web-based file storage. However, the cloud concept goes back much further than that. The first cloud was an offshoot of mainframe technology that enabled people to access data from anywhere using the Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, ARPANET, via the U.S. Department of Defense. All this means nothing to you as a modern cloud consumer, and yet you wonder something that cloud users have been questioning for years. Where on earth is my data physically located? After all, it can't be floating around in cyberspace, can it? In a word, no. Computer data has to be stored on some sort of physical device, one way or another. The thing about the cloud is that data stored there does not need to be stored on your computer or mobile device. That is, in fact, the whole purpose of the cloud. Cloud computing is designed to get data and applications off individual devices and onto cloud servers instead. Let's talk about actual physical storage. Remember that your data and application must reside somewhere on a device that is both physical and tangible. They are not floating around in cyberspace. Cloud space exists on individual servers found at data centers and server farms around the world. Data center and co-location providers offer server space for cloud computing. It is easy to illustrate how we handle this by creating a fictional scenario. Let's say Acme Cloud Storage Company began offering consumer-level cloud storage to customers like you. They could lease hard disk space to servers from a specific provider. This provider would allocate as much space to them as necessary. They would then turn around and partition that space into smaller blocks of space that would be used to lease to you and your fellow Acme Cloud Storage Company customers. All of you would be storing your files on the exact same physical server. However, none of you would have access to anyone else's dedicated space. Individual spaces are kept separate through partitioning. Likewise, none of the other customers who lease space have access to the Acme Cloud Storage Company space. By now, you might be genuinely interested in the physical location of your own data. Finding out is not as easy as it sounds. There are data centers and server farms all over the world. Unfortunately, a lot of cloud providers do not maintain their own physical storage, so they lease. Moreover, they don't necessarily lease space in the same general location. You could have a United Kingdom cloud provider whose lease space is actually located in Dublin or Frankfurt. You can have a U.S. provider that leases space here as well as in the U.K. or German provider whose space is located in Belgium. The only way to find out where your data is physically located is ask your cloud provider. The lesson here is simple. Any data and apps you have in the cloud are physically stored in a server located at a data center or server farm. The space is all yours and physically separate so that others cannot access it. Presenting Marty Winston with Home Automation. The coronavirus pandemic will be stretching into the winter. This is unlike the typical winter of old. Marty will talk about what's the same as well as focus on what's different. It's no wonderland.
Isn't it a romantic image? A winter wonderland. Well, not so much this year. This segment is called No Wonderland, partly because of what's different, partly because a lot of it leaves you saying, no wonder, and part of it, well, you'll see. Anyway, what is there to wonder about? The eventual prevention and cure for COVID-19? Probably not until well after this winter's over. Where our politics go from here? No wondering there, about half of us will hate any given outcome. Wondering when work will return to normal or shopping? Probably not until next winter, so stop wondering about that stuff and just pay attention to whatever opportunities you have. There are always the more familiar wonders, like when the next big power outage will come, what the holidays will be like this year, and whether to get your hopes up about getting back to something you can recognize as normal anytime soon. Is that where your winter wonders land? We can cover a lot of this, but let's start with some tech stuff. Once we get a few basics out of the way. People settle into routines. Routines are familiar. Routines are predictable. When routines get disrupted, it can be deeply disturbing. The pandemic did that to us. The whole staying safe at home thing, the masks, the social distancing, the store closings, the office closings, the money issues, the riots, the issues with race and bigotry and police, movies, professional sports, unprofessional politics, primetime TV. It's all a little like being stranded at some isolated outpost with no ride home coming anytime soon. So, yeah, that all breeds stress and depression. The most popular primetime network drama, NCIS, is starting its season in November. It usually starts in September. It suddenly stopped last spring, so whatever this restart is, it may not feel like a new season. But it is a return to new episodes, and that is a little bit of stability right in the living room. And even if you had to give up your satellite or cable or fiber service, it's on broadcast TV where any cord cutter can get it for free. That helps. Do you know anybody who's grousing and complaining about the way that Sunday NFL games aren't like they used to be? Okay, but notice that doesn't make them stop watching. Watching TV, well, that's slowly returning to relevancy. Not just binge-watching, more like normal. It will get there, including all the Frosty Rudolph Santa and romance mush holiday fare you can handle. The TV set will return to its traditional role as a gathering point. Return to? What gathering point replaced it? Make that point. Smartphones, tablets, notebooks. That's where everyone's been going to watch. Solo. Alone. No human interaction. Recognize that? It's a traditional recipe for loneliness. Oh, a lot of us will still be on those data networks during our work days or school days. Learning and working from home are a continuing reality now, though it's beginning to see increasing variety in its scheduling. And people, slowly, are learning to cope. The retail store, one retail store, Bed Bath & Beyond, has been doing a booming business in helping people make their home work areas more comfortable. Hello? How long can anyone sit cross-legged on a bed in pajamas with a notebook actually being a laptop and not be annoyed by that? Any little table is better. A lamp might be useful. A chair that doesn't cut off the blood flow to your backside. Those little things. It's about adapting. Not that there isn't a lot of grousing and complaining when that needs to happen, but when our context changes and we don't, things just don't fit. In a lot of ways, the whole year is a misfit. The storm patterns are crazy. You just know power problems are ahead. Double-check your stock of sweaters, blankets, flashlights, candles, batteries. One thing that's different this year is that with much lower power demands from offices and factories, the grid isn't getting slammed as hard as usual. So winter power line damage is likely to occur a little less often and get fixed a little more quickly. The only place you may want to have a battery backup these days is at the modem and router. And however stressful summer and fall may seem, they both have more daylight hours. And one of the differences that makes is seasonal affective disorder. We're heading into the sad SAD season now. It makes people moody. It saps energy. Clinically, it's a form of depression. It can mean losing interest in activities that you used to find involving, having trouble concentrating, having trouble sleeping, feeling like you have no hope, like you're worthless, or getting some kind of sense of guilt. Depression does that. SAD does that. So, if you or somebody living with you is oversleeping, gains weight, shows fatigue, or craves a lot more carbs, treat it seriously. Check with online medical resources, or you may be able to get an appointment with a psychotherapist. If nothing else, investigate light therapy. Depression is not the same as anger, and anger is not the same as violence. Anger without violence is almost unavoidable, especially in an election year, especially after indulging in adult beverages. Anger is a behavior that some people learn by habit to favor, which can be hard on those under the same roof, especially children. Arguments won't quell anger. Sometimes laughter can. Sometimes a pet can. Try to think about your alternatives before you're compelled to choose one. One dodge that may work, especially if introduced before things escalate into anger, is asking for help with online shopping. Sure, sometimes it just redirects the anger, like, why is it so hard to shop for a long-sleeve pocket polo shirt in my size? Or jeans, or shoes that won't slip on the ice. And since when are alligator clips worth $2 each? Two other elements of winter that not quite enough people ever consider. Two sleepy cousins, carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. Either one can make oxygen hard to get. And with furnaces firing up now, either one can make a sudden appearance. Keeping an eye on IAQ, indoor air quality, can include those two factors, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide. There's a Yoo-Hoo here, that's U-H-O-O, and an Erethings, and a Kytera egg. They all report on CO2 levels. The Yoo-Hoo also reports on carbon monoxide levels and a bunch of other factors. Remember, not keeping an eye on carbon monoxide, well, that can start a nap that never ends. That might be an extreme case with carbon dioxide, but fatigue and some pains can result when it gets out of balance with oxygen. Fatigue and sleepiness without the gloomy moodiness of depression could mean it's CO2, not seasonal affective disorder. Air the rooms out. Bring in HVAC repair, get your air back in balance, and see if that helps. Finally, keep your eyes open for the things that might be helpful for other family members or friends. It might be a new chair, or a cushion for the old one, or a warmer sweater, or a better headset for those online calls and meetings, or maybe just a kit of lens and screen cleaners. Winter isn't entirely a no wonderland. They'll always wonder what's waiting inside the holiday gift wrap. Next time, how's your peripheral vision? No, not that kind. How much do you keep an eye on add-ons or accessories that enhance the usefulness of a basic product? For that matter, how many have you seen that are a total waste of time and space? Be here for next week's segment, Peripheral Roles. And some of those roles may be toasted.
Thank you, Maury. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For update information, visit the website of the computer club. The Brookdale Computer Users Group, What is the Right Way to Repair Movement? Thursday, September 24th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is pcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on web services, Thursday, October the 1st, 2020, at 7 p.m., via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, October the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, October the 9th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. And the Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 9th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. And their website is acgnj.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.